Hi, I'm Aaron Schachter. Welcome to the special podcast of The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. China's one-child generation is growing up in a time of transition. The Communist Party's more focused on growing the economy and maintaining stability than on indoctrinating the masses. Few Chinese believe in communism anymore, but most young Chinese were raised without a belief in anything else. And now some of them are seeking to fill that void. In part 5 of our series, Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing on young China's search for meaning.
On a playground after school, kids in the Communist Party's Young Pioneers Movement practice marching to patriotic songs. The party starts early in trying to instill belief in and loyalty to the party. These days, though, it's more about national pride than communist ideology. Nationalism does have some resonance in the younger generation, but the almost religious fervor their parents and grandparents once showed for the Communist Party is long gone. A young woman I'll call Chen Lan, because she doesn't want her real name used, says her parents have become disillusioned.
Basically, they don't believe in any God, because they grew up, they witnessed how a certain person have been created as a god.
You mean Mao?
Yes, so that's why they don't believe in any god.
But Chen does. She became a Christian while studying in England a couple of years ago, at first because she was lonely and just wanted to have a sense of community. But then, she says, she found practicing Christianity helped her in her day-to-day life.
Before believing in God, I really believed that people around always hurt me. I've been looked down upon, yeah, because I'm not beautiful and probably I'm not really an excellent student and I'm not good enough. Before believing in God, I don't really love myself, but now I just feel that I have confidence in God.
Chen is part of a phenomenon in China. As belief in the Communist Party has waned and life in China has become more competitive and stressful and materialistic, more and more Chinese, especially young Chinese, have gone in search of meaning. Victor Yuan runs China's top survey group, Horizon Research. It did a survey a decade ago asking people what they believed in. The top answers at the time were myself, money, and nothing. The Communist Party ranked near the bottom. Yuan says Horizon recently asked the same question again and found the percentage of people who call themselves religious had grown significantly.
All the religion got new believers. So all the systematic religions, they got more believers.
Yuan says members of China's one-child generation are showing a particular interest in religion, but in their own signature style, shopping around, trying things out, and finding what suits them.
That's true, because at first, they're very individualized. They believe everything belongs to themselves, but also including their personal faith. They want to find something they want to believe. And this generation is more open.
Another recent survey, reported in state-run media, found that almost one-third of Chinese 16 and over are now religious. That's about 400 million people, or four times the Chinese government's previous estimate. But no one seems to be panicking in the Communist Party. To the contrary, there seems to be a sense that a little moral guidance in an increasingly corrupt and harsh society isn't a bad thing, as long as it doesn't threaten the party's continued rule. The party has, in the past, cracked down hard on perceived threats, such as the spiritual sect Falun Gong, and on underground Christian churches, known as house churches. But these days, house churches are operating with a little less fear of reprisal. That could be because the government is realizing that many of the worshippers aren't exactly political radicals. Take Fei Fei, who's 17.
I'm not really interested in politics. It's God who decides who has power. So it's not necessary for us to worry about who will be the leaders of the country. We should just pray for them.
Fei Fei is among those singing here at a house church in southern Beijing. About 20 people have gathered on this Sunday morning to hear the 26-year-old preacher read psalms and lead a discussion. He's an advertising executive by day. He agrees to talk as long as I don't use his name. Crackdowns on house churches have relaxed, but they haven't disappeared. The preacher says he was raised without a religion and was drawn to Christianity because it offered something he felt his life lacked.
In Chinese culture, love is not emphasized. Instead, we're told what's important is self-reliance, knowledge, and social recognition. Those kind of things were instilled into us more than love. I don't think my parents and grandparents really knew how to love me. Their expectations of me were not in line with what I wanted, so we argued often.
Now, he says, his mother has also become a practicing Christian, and even his father, a Communist Party member, is expressing some interest. The preacher says it's helped their relationship immensely. Even more than Christianity, Buddhism is enjoying a revival of interest in China, especially Tibetan Buddhism, which adherents say is a purer form than what's practiced now in the rest of the country. This Tibetan Buddhist monastery is in Shahe, in western China's Gansu province. It's become trendy in some Chinese circles to embrace things Tibetan, and this place has become a popular tourist destination. Nearby, a young man named Chen Hai from eastern China is hanging out in a Tibetan tanka painter's studio.
Before I came here, I didn't know anything about Buddhism, not to mention Tibetan Buddhism. A lot of my friends listened to radio programs on Buddhism, but it took me coming here to be touched and amazed by the sincerity of their devotion.
Another Tibetan Buddhist convert is 24-year-old Zhang Jinyan. She and her husband Hu Jia are prominent AIDS activists in China. When Hu Jia was arrested and then put under house arrest, Zhang began speaking out. She started a blog and made a film about the secret police outside their apartment. She became a Buddhist about a year ago. She says its central idea of mercy or benevolence appealed to her and was in sync with her work. She says her belief in Buddhism also helped her deal with the injustice she and her husband face on a daily basis.
There's a concept in Buddhism that people suffer a lot of sadness in life, like birth, disease, and death. And the things that happen to us are just another kind of sadness that people can experience. We have suffered a lot of unfair treatment because we work for social justice. And as Buddhists, we can be calm about this and take it as a part of life that will pass.
That last sentiment may sound like what the Communist Party was talking about when it called religion the opiate of the masses. But Zhang Jinyan is just one young Chinese person who is showing that her religion is no opiate. It's a motivating force, a source of strength, and the meaning that had been missing growing up in what many feel has been a morally rudderless era. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
The Chinese government started a one-child policy 27 years ago to slow down explosive population growth. The policy was designed to speed the creation of a sizable middle class. The policy, along with economic reform, has done that, but now it's doing something else. It's speeding the graying of China, and it's raising the question of whether China will grow old before it grows rich. The World's Mary Kay Magstad continues our series on young China.
Old men and women sit around a stone table on a steamy summer morning in Beijing, playing cards and trading quips. The men have rolled up their pant legs to beat the summer heat. One of the women fans herself with a sprawling paper fan. It's a familiar scene here, and one that will be getting all the more common soon. A gray wave is bearing down on China, and China's one-child generation is all too aware of what awaits it two or three decades down the pike. The prospect of each only child caring for two aging parents and up to four grandparents. It's a duty enshrined by a law that was passed a decade ago in China. Dai Jun is a 25-year-old business student and an only child. He says it's true that some only children would rather make money and hang out with their friends rather than take care of their aging parents. But he accepts that caring for his parents is his duty.
I think they give me set examples, no matter good or bad. I think lots of things I learned from them, and they raise you up. They give you money to date with girls, and they give you money to go to the college. So it is, I think you should have to pay something back.
But he worries about how much he'll have to pay. China has one of the world's most rapidly aging populations, and those who are old are living much longer. But China's pension and health insurance systems are minimal at best, and health care for serious illness would bankrupt most Chinese. Dai Jun hopes to make good money, but given these structural problems, he still worries about the challenges ahead.
Because China really have lots of problems. Although the the progress of the GDP improvement really astonishing. But there are lots of problems.
A demographic perfect storm is brewing in China. First, life expectancy has increased from 41 to 70 since the Communist Party came to power in 1949. Second, former leader Mao Zedong misguidedly declared in the 1950s that China needed more people. He even gave awards to mothers who had the most. So, China now has a huge baby boom generation in its 40s and 50s. And third, Mao's successor, Deng Xiaoping, tried to right the balance by declaring a one-child-per-family policy. That smaller generation is just starting to come of age. Richard Jackson is a demographer at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He says China now faces a huge challenge.
You have the prospect of 400 million Chinese elders by the year 2040, 80% of whom do not have any formal retirement pension, most of whom won't have access to government-financed health care. They're depending on the extended family, but the government told them not to have children, or at least not to have more than one, or in some cases two. So the humanitarian crisis of colossal proportions looms in China's future.
So far, the demographic dividend of a lower birth rate and a longer lifespan has worked in China's favor, driving its economic growth. That's because the bulk of the population is still of working age. The Chinese government has even predicted that by 2040, China's economy will surpass that of the United States. But in 2040, almost 30% of China's population will be past retirement age. That's compared with 11% now. Jackson says this means China could become the first major economy to grow old before it grows rich. And, ironically, the one-child policy, which was meant to speed the growth of the middle class, has contributed to that problem.
Fertility has fallen everywhere in the world along with development. This seems to be an almost ironclad law of development. What the one-child policy has done is to change the timing of the fertility decline. It has meant that fertility has declined sooner in China, in an earlier stage of development, than it otherwise would have.
Jackson says China's demographic turning point comes in just 8 years. That's when the working age population stops growing. A few years later, it will start to decline, and the number of retirees will grow. Now there are 6 working people supporting every retired person in China. By 2040, there will be just 2. This comes amidst other immense social changes, especially in family life. For millennia, Chinese parents depended on their children to take care of them in old age. But the rural young are increasingly moving to cities to find work, and the urban young are going abroad or carving out lives for themselves away from their parents. A recent survey found that 60% of elderly Chinese still live with their children, but growing numbers are looking for alternatives. One is Beijing's Social Welfare Institute number one for the elderly. It's a nursing home. Cao Sujuan has been working here since it opened almost 2 decades ago.
Back then, this place had few residents because most elderly people preferred to live with their families.
Now, she says, there are more than 500 residents here, with dozens more on the waiting list.
I think this shows that people's attitudes are changing. These days, more older people are financially independent. And at the same time, they feel their children are busy with their own lives and stressed out from work. They don't want to create an extra burden for them. So a place like this is a good option.
This place is probably as good as it gets when it comes to nursing homes in China. It's modern, clean, and comfortable. There's a hospital right next door, and plenty of activities for those who are interested. 80-year-old Li Ke is painting an intricate swirl of flowers and leaves on parchment paper.
I think this is a good place for old people. I threw out all my furniture and other stuff I didn't need. I no longer have to pay bills. And here, I have plenty of friends and plenty to do.
Li Ke literally wears rose-colored glasses, framed by tousled white hair. She's tall and lanky and still energetic enough that it's not hard to imagine her in her younger days as a journalist going down mine shafts to talk to coal workers. She moved here a few years ago after her husband died. Her four grown children visit regularly.
Every Sunday, my daughter comes to visit me. Sometimes I tell her she doesn't need to come so often. I'm doing just fine here. She says I should give my children a chance to show their filial devotion. I tell her that when I'm lying in bed sick and can't move anymore, that will be the time to show that they care for their old mother.
Some other residents are not as upbeat about the separation from their children. Liu Rei Zhang is a former biochemistry teacher. At 74, she's been a widow for more than a decade. Her son, an only child, lives with his family in Canada. Liu says sometimes she wishes she hadn't given them money to help them move there. She says she feels an emotional emptiness, and her eyes brim with tears when she says this modern scattered family life isn't how she'd envisioned her old age.
Bothered me very much. So sometimes I feel really the life is not interesting. I always feel sad.
But at least Liu has a comfortable place to live and a pension that pays her expenses. Even among the one-fifth of Chinese who do have pensions, it's often not enough to live on. One of the challenges the Chinese government now faces is to get an effective basic pension system in place before the graying of China accelerates. Gao Xiqing is the vice chairman of China's National Council for Social Security Fund.
It should really be our main task to try to educate general public, you know, and the government as well, and to try to advocate to them that this is really a very important issue and a very pressing issue. For us, we think it's something that's looming large. It's an imminent problem.
The problem has been made worse by local governments raiding their local social security funds to pay for other projects or, all too often, to line their own pockets. Gao feels the state owes people in their 50s and above, those who grew up under communism, who lived through political upheavals and pledged their loyalty to Mao. Gao, in his mid-50s, is on the tail end of that generation. He says the state promised his and older generations that it would take care of them in exchange for their hard labor, so people weren't paid what their labor was really worth. Gao himself was one of the urban youth sent down to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution in the late 1960s. He worked on a railway project in central China for $5 a month.
When I was on railroad, I was paid 13 yuan a month on very, very hard labor for no hour limits. We worked from dawn to very, very dark and very often. We worked on three shifts all the time and, you know, rationed food. So in those days, everyone worked like that.
Gao is doing fine now himself, but he says he stays in touch with the rural laborers who toiled with him. Many are in poor health and most have no pension. Nor do they have as many kids to take care of them as their parents did, thanks to the one-child policy. Gao says the image of his friends from the railway, growing old with no safety net, keeps him motivated to do what he can. He hopes the one-child generation stays motivated too, because a heavy burden rests on its shoulders. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Beijing.
China's youth is growing up during a time of national prosperity. But China's leaders realize to keep the economy growing, China has to move beyond manufacturing other countries' goods. It needs to start creating its own products. So they're pouring billions of dollars into promoting innovation. Young Chinese are embracing innovation, but many are also embracing the idea of having opinions of their own. Mary Kay Magstead has the final part in our Young China series.
In a gleaming new science park in a corner of Beijing, Microsoft and Google and more than 100 other international companies have opened research and development offices. They employ some of China's top young technological minds. Herbert Chen is vice president of the Tsinghua University Science Park. He says it's great that so many major international companies want to come here to do their R&D, but he's more excited about the hundreds of small Chinese startup companies here that are trying to create their own original products. He says China does make some money from the foreign designed products it produces, but it doesn't make as much as it could because it has to pay royalties.
You can say, we are producing a DVD player. We have to pay the royalty. We pay a lot of money for that. We are working for the foreigners, the international companies. Right? We're working hard. But the most benefit not coming to the Chinese government pocket, it goes to overseas.
And the Chinese government wants that to change. It wants China to get back in touch with its inventive roots, the ones that gave the world the compass, paper, printing, and gunpowder 2,000 years ago. It wants modern China to emulate the success of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. They all went through the world's factory phase that China is in now, but then they started creating their own high-value products and building their own international brands. China's leaders realize their economy needs to make this transition if it's to continue to grow in the long term. But to do that, it needs creative minds. And that's where the Chinese education system becomes an issue. These primary school kids are reciting in unison what they'll do when they get home, their homework. Lessons are often taught like this, too. Pei Di Na is a professor at Beijing Normal University, a teacher's college.
If students want to do well on their exams, they have to listen to the teachers and repeat exactly what they say. If they ask many questions, the teacher will scold them and say, "Why are you so stupid?" So the students don't dare challenge the teacher.
Pei Di Na says this leads to a society where it's hard for students to surpass their teachers. She and others like her have been working for years to reform the system, to encourage children to use their imaginations and creativity. And some reforms have been made. The problem is, no matter how creative Chinese children's education becomes, they still face a time at the end of senior year when their future rides on getting the answers right. This group of anxious parents is standing outside a Beijing high school. Their children are inside, taking a grueling 2-day test that will decide their future. Many of the parents have been here all day in the hot sun. For most, this is their only child on whom all their hopes ride. And the National College Entrance Exam is the only thing that China's universities consider for admission. The pressure is extraordinary. A hotel attendant named Liu Changchuan has taken the day off to be here for his daughter.
She's been studying hard for the past year, just getting 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night and studying the rest of the time. We've even spent thousands of dollars on extra classes for her. Now, it's up to her.
It's not unusual for Chinese kids to exhaust themselves studying for this exam. Some have even been known to commit suicide. Liu says his daughter is a bit unusual in that she doesn't believe this exam is going to determine her future.
She looks at Bill Gates as a model. She says Bill Gates never even got a university diploma, but he's still a powerful person.
Bill Gates is a model for many young Chinese, as are a few homegrown entrepreneurs along the same model. Daijie Kang is one. At 26, he's a multimillionaire. He sits in his executive office in a t-shirt, khaki shorts, and Nikes. His company, ComSense, is China's leading provider of software for online bulletin boards. Dai wrote this software as a teenager, around the time he dropped out of college. He thinks real innovation comes from regular exposure to new ideas and new ways of thinking. He says this has been happening in China despite the education system. He credits the internet, satellite TV, and ever more contact with the outside world.
Thoughts open not only for this generation, but I have found that the thoughts in my parents has been changed every day.
Dai says his parents have had a chance to explore and develop their own interests, their own sense of individual identity, a sharp contrast from the enforced uniformity of their youth during the Cultural Revolution.
In old generation, everybody looks all the same, and they have the same thoughts, they have the same custom, and they have the same education. But in this generation, I think once they have touched the whole of the world, they will find a chance to make their lives better or realize their personal characteristic.
You can see that in how young Chinese follow fashion, snap up the latest high-tech gadgets, and start blogs. You can also see it in how this younger generation insists on finding its own information and making its own decisions, says Victor Yuan. He's head of Horizon Research, China's premier consumer and social behavior survey group. He says young Chinese, and especially only children, are used to making the call on how to spend much of the family's disposable income. He even calls them little prime ministers. And he says they don't automatically respect authority.
They have that kind of perspective that I have a right to do a self-judgment if you are really a proper boss, and if here is really a proper workplace, I should stay. Even their status family, if the parents treat them badly, they simply live away. If you not treat me well, then I can leave.
It doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that kind of thinking spilling over into the realm of politics. Yuan says he's found in his surveys that many young adults in the one-child generation express political opinions in a way their elders never would have dreamed of doing.
If you ask people, for example, 65 years old, what's their reaction to government performance, their first initial reaction is, how can I talk about the government performance? They basically believe that's not their business. They have no right to do that. But for the young kids, they believe they have a right to do that.
Yuan says there are now government websites where citizens can make complaints, give comments, and rate the performance of local officials. And these comments are taken into account when the official's pay raise or promotion is being considered. Horizon Research has also done surveys asking young adults to rate the government.
So if I say, look, the best is a 10, the worst is a 1, I would say 0.
Which would be fine in a democracy. But this is the People's Republic of China, a one-party authoritarian state. While the government is taking tentative steps to become more responsive to the population, there are clear limits. It's willing to tolerate constructive criticism, not a challenge to its rule. So the government is not only promoting innovation and creative thinking, it's also promoting something else. You can see it here in a classroom on a Saturday morning, filled with middle-aged professionals. They're learning about Confucius. The professor is Li Zhanghua.
Confucianism advocates harmony between human beings and nature, between people and society, and between society and government. The harmony advocated by Confucius is a core Chinese value.
Confucianism stresses not just harmony and ethical behavior. It also advocates adhering to a strict social hierarchy. Children should obey their parents, wives their husbands, and subjects their leaders. But a return to Confucian values may not hold the same appeal for the younger generation. At the 700-year-old Confucian Temple in Beijing, which is now being renovated, a young Chinese woman carrying a parasol strolls past stone carvings of Confucian sayings. She gives her name as Erin. She's 28. She says for her, this place is just a tourist site, and Confucianism a relic of the past.
My generation wouldn't want to apply those principles in our lives because Chinese believe in competition, and there are great economic and cultural changes in China. So with so much pressure, I don't think people can set such rigid standards for themselves. They can just take what works for them from the philosophy as basic guidance.
Erin's approach is a world away from what her parents' generation did when they were young, chanting communist slogans and accepting what they were told. Her generation's insistence on picking and choosing and asking questions helps drive a dynamism that is transforming China. Many young Chinese are all too aware of the problems China faces, but they also know its potential. China is reclaiming its place as one of the world's preeminent powers. What kind of power it will be, how creative, how peaceful, how powerful, and how democratic may depend on how young China navigates its own potential. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Beijing.
That concludes the second of our Young China podcasts. The entire series, transcripts, and Mary Kay Magstead's photography from China are available at theworld.org. If you want to share your thoughts about these stories, you can join our online discussion or send an email to theworld@pri.org. I'm Aaron Schachter. Thanks for listening.